We are thrilled to have Panacea Financial as a sponsor, providing banking built for doctors by doctors. Hear what Dr. Michael Juergens, a MedPeds physician and co-founder of Panacea Financial, had to say.
So as a bank, we have checking accounts and high yield savings accounts. It's all accessible on our online banking or mobile app. So you can do your direct deposit there. Like anything you would do at a normal bank, we have accessible on our online and mobile banking. You have your own personal banker. We have a high yield savings account. We actually have a lot of people use it for that purpose. I see very commonly people build up an emergency fund. We have a high interest rate. They put in 3 months of expenses there, kind of set it and forget it. And then hopefully they never need it. But if they do, it was growing interest that whole time. And actually, I'm very proud because I think we're still the number one rated bank on Trustpilot. And that's all based on our culture and being a mission-driven company that's for doctors by doctors.
I am so impressed with the company and the team and the culture and the features that they've built. We will link all the info for Panacea Financial in the show notes. Panacea Financial is a division of Primus, member FDIC. Welcome to the sixth installment of Beyond Journal Club, a collaboration between Core AM and NEJM Group.
The goal of Beyond Journal Club is to take landmark clinical trials and put them into context, telling the story of how we got to where we are and what it means for how we take care of our patients.
So today we're talking about the widely publicized colonoscopy study, the Nordic Trial. I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi, an internist at BIDMC.
I'm Dr. Greg Katz, a cardiologist at NYU.
And I'm Dr. Abby Schubach, an NEJM editorial fellow and hospitalist at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Today we are talking about the Nordic Trial, published in the October 27th issue of the New England Journal of Medicine in 2022.
So Abby, I know you're pretty passionate about this topic, and it's not just because you're going to be a gastroenterologist.
Yeah, Shreya, I am for many reasons. But, you know, over 50,000 people die in the U.S. from colon cancer every year, and I really wish that number was lower. If we can get colon cancer screening right, we can save many lives.
And so this is where Nordic can come in. This trial asked the question, does offering colonoscopy screening reduce the incidence of colorectal cancer? And does it prevent death related to colorectal cancer or death overall?
Yeah, so good questions. But it was really interesting to find that Nordic actually made a pretty big splash in the news with some quite mixed messages. On one hand, places like CNN described the study as the benefits of colon cancer screening may be overestimated, while places like Washington Post published articles entitled, "Don't cancel your colonoscopy just yet."
And it wasn't just the media that was kind of mixed messages. Tons of smart doctors I know had really strong opinions on both sides here. I'm talking about serious people, not just influencers, but serious doctors who are making real decisions, taking care of real patients who had strong opinions about both positive and negative interpretations of this trial.
Whenever a study gets a lot of press, it can be hard to figure out what the true message really is. And so I wanted to figure out, how does this trial change your thinking about the value of colonoscopy?
And so first, we'll talk about the pathophysiology of colorectal cancer and the theory about why screening makes sense.
Then we'll take a step back to look at the big picture on general cancer screening to help understand why it's so hard to show a benefit in a screening trial.
Yeah, and then we'll get into the story of all the colorectal cancer trials before the Nordic.
And finally, we'll do a deep dive into Nordic to help bring some clarity to the mixed message chaos.
Guys, in prepping for this episode, I was so surprised to learn that a procedure like a colonoscopy that's recommended to everyone in the U.S. has never been studied in a randomized control trial.
Shreya, I was shocked as well. It made more sense to me, though, when I delved into how hard it is to study the benefit of a screening test and just how long it actually takes for colon cancer to develop.
Yeah, good stuff. So let's get into that. What's the life cycle of colon cancer?
So colon cancer often follows a pretty clear progression, which starts first at adenoma, then finally carcinoma. The caveat, of course, is that some cancers can develop without a preceding polyp, like a de novo cancer. But most colorectal cancers move through that adenoma pathway.
Yeah, so if we're thinking about cancers going down that typical pathway, what kind of the time frame we're looking at for an adenoma to progress to cancer?
So the timeline varies a lot depending on size and type of adenoma. It can be as long as 26 years for a diminutive adenoma, which is smaller than 5 millimeters, 9 years for a tubular villous adenoma, 8 years for a small adenoma, 5 years for a large one, and actually it only takes 4 years for a villous adenoma to develop to cancer.
So we're talking anywhere from 2 decades to a little less than 10 years, except for those more scary large adenomas or villous adenomas, which are more or less around 4 to 5 years.
Yeah, so that timeline makes the impact of colorectal cancer screening really hard to study. After an adenoma is removed, the potential cancer would likely not develop for an average of 8 to 10 years after that.
Yeah, so that's a lot of years of follow-up, and that's only for the development of cancer, right? Say we're talking about cancer or death, that's going to take a lot longer, right? People, after they're diagnosed with colon cancer, undergo treatment, so we're talking many, many more years after.
And it gets even more complicated if you want to show a benefit in all-cause mortality, because, you know, colon cancer is usually something that we describe as pretty common, but it isn't all that common. Only about 4% of people are going to develop colon cancer in their lifetime. So that means that 96% of people in a screening study will just never be dealing with this disease.
Yeah, man. I don't do stats for a living. I definitely don't do stats for a living, but I'm just getting anxiety thinking about the power calculations to show a mortality benefit and just overall trying to design a study that demonstrates a benefit in screening. It seems pretty intimidating.
And so even beyond the statistical questions, there's also a little bit of a controversy about which outcomes matter most for a study like this. Some people think the most important metric in a screening test should be all-cause mortality. Some think it should be cancer-specific mortality. And some think it's fine to just make it a diagnosis of the specific cancer in question.
Yeah. Greg, for the first one you mentioned, the all-cause mortality, the argument is that our patients don't usually care what they die from, but they just don't want to die.
The counterpoint to arguing that all-cause mortality is the be-all and end-all when in a cancer screening trial misses some other points, which is that these trials take all comers. The vast majority of people are not getting that specific cancer. And so you need to think a little bit about how many people you're going to need to enroll to see a difference in all-cause mortality when so many of the people in that screening test are just not affected by the cancer in question.
Yeah. So even though that all-cause mortality metric is important, I do like the colorectal cancer specific metric because after all, colonoscopies just look at the colon and the rectum. And so maybe that's the effect we should be targeting.
I like that. I like that. So it sounds like there's benefits, drawbacks to each strategy. I think one takeaway, though, is very clear. Proving that screening is effective requires studying a lot of people for a long time.
So let's get back to the story on colorectal cancer before we circle back to Nordic.
So before the Nordic trial, the story to support screening for colorectal cancer came from randomized controlled trials looking at sigmoidoscopy and large observational studies looking at both sigmoidoscopy and colonoscopy.
And so let's start with the observational studies. And whenever I look at observational studies, I keep in mind that these trials are hypothesis generating. They're not really hypothesis testing. And so an observational study can overestimate or underestimate the impact of an intervention. That's sometimes because of confounding variables that we know or can sort of calculate in our heads. But it's often because of important unmeasured confounders that we don't realize or just don't know that exist.
Yeah, observational studies can either over or underestimate the benefit of a colonoscopy because of the inability to adjust for important factors, such as the tendency of healthier people to generally seek preventative care, but also something as simple as someone who has a strong family history of colorectal cancer might prompt them to go out and actually seek the screening.
Yeah, and to add to that, you mentioned that some of these studies were using sigmoidoscopies, and I feel like sigmoidoscopy studies probably underestimate the effect of colonoscopy screening, right? Just from the sheer anatomical perspective that we're not looking at the whole colon and just a part of it.
So keeping in mind the limitations of those observational studies, there have been two large prospective observational studies, one published in NEJM in 2013, which looked at screening colonoscopy and sigmoidoscopy. Another published in the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2017, which looked just at colonoscopy. And so these studies were really big. The NEJM study was almost 90,000 patients followed for over 2 decades. The ANNAL study was over 1 million patients that was followed for about 8 years.
Yeah. And both of these observational studies observed a lower rate of colorectal cancer in screened patients compared to unscreened patients.
The NEJM study also observed that fewer people died from colorectal cancer in the colonoscopy screened patients. And the hazard ratio there was 0.32, which is pretty impressive. And it's worth noting here that only colonoscopy was associated with lower mortality from proximal colon cancer.
Right, right. Of course, we didn't see this with a sigmoidoscopy cohort, right? Just from the sheer perspective that the sigmoidoscopy doesn't get to the proximal colon.
Yeah, let's take a second to review the anatomy. So sigmoidoscopy is just going to show you the area from the rectum to the sigmoid. A colonoscopy, however, will go past this. So it'll go up the descending colon on the left side, over the transverse, down the ascending on the right side, and then all the way to the cecum that then attaches to the small bowel.
And that is why all these new GI fellows are having these cecum celebrations.
Yeah, exactly, Shreya, because they made it to the end, or I guess really the beginning of the colon.
Yes, yes. And I guess now that we've made it to the end, or should I say cecum, of the major observational studies, let's move on now to the randomized control trials that we've seen with sigmoidoscopies.
So there have been four key randomized controlled trials looking at sigmoidoscopy, all of which demonstrated a lower incidence of colorectal cancer in those invited to be screened compared to those not invited to be screened.
And so it's worth noting that all of the studies here are going to be invited to screen with scoping versus not invited to screen with scoping. Because ethically, you can't offer somebody a colorectal cancer screen and then pretend to do it or do a sham cancer screening.
Yeah, that would not be fun.
It would be wrong to tell somebody that you screened them for cancer, but you didn't actually screen them for cancer. And so maybe not fun, but it wouldn't be like the most wonderful thing that you could do for a patient.
That's the line we needed. Thank you, Greg.
Yeah.
Okay. So then in terms of it, so it sounds all great in terms of lowering incidence of colorectal cancer, but then in terms of mortality benefit, two of those four RCTs show that offering screening sigmoidoscopies did not reduce the colorectal cancer-related mortality rate, but the other two studies did show that the mortality was significantly reduced.
Yeah, Shreya. So it was half and half. Half showed a mortality benefit and half didn't. The analysis in those trials were an intention to screen analysis, meaning that they looked at everyone who was invited to undergo the screening, knowing that a lot of these people actually didn't do it. A lot of these studies also do a separate analysis called a per protocol analysis. This only looks at patients who actually completed the screening. And these did show a significant mortality benefit in all four studies.
And this may be a good time to pause for anyone else who mixes up per protocol and intention to treat, which I know here is technically intention to screen, not intention to treat, but bear with me here. One way I think I've made it stick for myself is a T for intention to treat. Like think of that T as a T for trial. So intention to treat is looking at by the books, what did this trial randomize you to and what was the outcome, whether you did or you didn't get that treatment. And then P for per protocol reminds me of the P in patient. So per protocol stratifying to what the patients actually got.
So keeping those two lines straight is really helpful, not just for understanding the trials, but for understanding the arguments about which of these analyses is actually better for a screening test. And so there's this line of argument in the world of cancer screening that really believes we should be doing all of these analyses as per protocol rather than intention to screen so that we can better capture the true impact of that screening test itself. But I find it hard to find that argument truly like fully persuasive. And so if you think about that, we're using these trials to make policy and to make recommendations about what we're going to offer to our patients. And if you're just using a per protocol analysis, you lose the ability to evaluate the impact of that invitation to be screened for cancer.
Yeah, exactly. So to put this more simply, you can analyze it based off of what people did or what people were assigned to. If you analyze it in any other way, though, than what people were invited or assigned to, unfortunately, you lose that special benefit of randomization.
Right, right. So I think either way, though, it's fair to say that the mortality and the colorectal incidence are definitely going to differ based on if you look at the people who were just invited to be screened versus who actually got the screening scope.
Exactly. And this is exactly what happened in the SCORE trial, Shreya, one of the four RCTs on sigmoidoscopy. In the intention to treat analysis, the mortality rate was actually not statistically different compared to the control group, but the per protocol analysis told a different story. In this analysis, there was a drop in both the incidence of colorectal cancer and death.
As we're going to see later with our discussion of Nordic, this seems to be a theme in cancer screening trials. Inviting people to screen may not save lives, but it seems like there's a signal that actually undergoing the screening probably does. It's almost like it's not good enough just to have an idea. You actually need to be able to execute a plan to make things work in the real world. And so all this data is where the recommendations in the US for colonoscopy came from, even before RCT data on colonoscopy, because we do have data that looking at the colon and taking out polyps with sigmoidoscopy saves lives related to colorectal cancer.
Yeah. So when we look at these recommendations, it surprised me to find that it actually wasn't until the mid-90s when the first screening recommendations for sigmoidoscopy were published by the USPSTF. And then it wasn't until 2000 when the American College of Gastroenterology became the first organization to recommend screening colonoscopy instead of sigmoidoscopy.
You know, it's so hard for me not to think twice and think, isn't it interesting that it's a gastroenterology society that was the first to recommend colonoscopy? And yeah, same. It didn't dawn on me that these recommendations were so recent in the last two decades. I thought colonoscopies had been done for decades and decades.
After that American College of Gastroenterology recommendation, the United States Preventive Services Task Force actually waited a couple of years before they came out and recommended colonoscopies in 2002. Their recommendations, they acknowledge this is an extrapolation from sigmoidoscopy data, and they even qualified that recommendation with the statement that said, quote, "It is not certain whether the potential added benefits of colonoscopy relative to screening alternatives are large enough to justify the added risks and inconvenience for all patients."
And with all that context, let's move on to the Nordic trial.
So Nordic asked the question, does offering screening colonoscopy reduce incidence and mortality from colorectal cancer?
And as we alluded to earlier, this is the first randomized controlled trial to ask this question about colonoscopies.
Yeah, so then who was enrolled in the Nordic trial?
So eligible people were all men and women aged 55 to 64 years old who lived in Norway, Poland, Sweden, and the Netherlands. And of these countries, Poland was the only one that had an ongoing colorectal cancer screening program.
Really? Poland was the only one that had a robust colon cancer screening program? I didn't realize that in Europe, they didn't routinely do these screening colonoscopies.
Does that mean that GI fellowships are less competitive to get into in European countries?
That is a great point. I don't know. Someone please write it and let us know. But I don't know. I'm just thinking, like, if the salary is still high, I think probably all bets are off.
That's true.
Okay. Very funny. But in all seriousness, European leaders are still trying to use this trial to figure out whether implementing a nationwide screening program with colonoscopy makes sense.
Okay. So this is an example of a study that could have some pretty good policy implications, since it sounds like colonoscopy was less widely accepted in Europe compared to the United States.
Yeah, and part of the reason why colonoscopy is so much less common is actually that sedation is much less common as well.
Oh, that does not sound like fun. I mean, I don't blame people. Like, without sedation, I would also hard pass a colonoscopy.
Me too, unless I could bring my own anesthesiologist. And so let's get back to Nordic. And so individuals in this trial were randomly assigned to either being offered colonoscopy screening versus no invitation to screening, which was termed the usual care group.
And just to clarify what exactly that invitation to screen meant, it was basically a letter that was sent to the invited to screen group with a date and a time for their colonoscopy. And in one country, only after a response call was done was a date and time given, but that was only 10% of the invited to screen group.
And interestingly, among the 31,000 participants who were assigned to colonoscopy, only 40% actually accepted the invitation and underwent the procedure.
Only 40%? Man, that really does confirm how unpopular colonoscopies are in Europe.
Yeah, in the US, it's a lot higher at about 60%. Quite a bit of a difference.
It's hard to imagine 60% of US adults agreeing on anything, let alone agreeing to have a colonoscopy, but that's great that the numbers are so high.
Yeah, man, totally. Okay, so on to the results. What was the difference between the groups that were invited to have the screening colonoscopy versus those who weren't invited?
The colorectal cancer risk at 10 years for the invited group was 0.98% compared to 1.2% in the usual care group. And so that's about a 20% reduction in colon cancer risk from being offered screening.
Yeah. And while a 20% risk reduction sounds pretty impressive, the number we care more about is the absolute risk reduction. And this was only 0.2%. Based off of this, the number needed to invite to prevent only one case of colorectal cancer within 10 years was pretty large at 455 people.
Yeah, that's a pretty large number of people to invite. But I guess considering the low incidence of colorectal cancer that Greg mentioned earlier, I think somewhere around 4%, I guess it makes sense that the number needed to invite is pretty high.
And when you look at the death from colorectal cancer or something like all-cause mortality, Nordic didn't show any difference between the invited to screen group versus the usual care group at 10 years.
Yeah, I guess that's not surprising either, right? Just inviting people to a colonoscopy didn't have a mortality benefit. But you guys were also teasing these like per protocol analyses. So I'm curious what that showed for the Nordic trial.
Yeah, Shreya. So just like the trials we had mentioned before, this per protocol analysis, unsurprisingly, had a much bigger reduction in colon cancer and even showed a drop in the number of deaths as well.
And so by using that per protocol analysis, the risk of colorectal cancer at 10 years decreased from 1.2% to about 0.84% in those who actually had the colonoscopy. And so that's about a 33% relative risk reduction in the incidence of colon cancer.
And what about the mortality reduction in that per protocol group?
The risk of death from colorectal cancer was 0.3% in the usual care group compared to 0.15% in the screen group. So you could look at this and say that actually getting screened with a colonoscopy cuts your risk of dying from colon cancer by 50%, or in other words, it cuts it in half.
Wow. So mortality reduction actually became significant if you analyze the results based on who actually got scoped.
Yes, exactly.
And if you go back to the intention to screen numbers, we know there's a 20% risk reduction in colorectal cancer incidence, but no mortality benefit. And so I was just kind of surprised that offering a colonoscopy didn't show a more impressive risk reduction. Abby, what do you make of those numbers?
Yeah, Greg, I was surprised too. I think we have to keep in mind that Nordic only followed people for 10 years. And we talked about earlier that sometimes it can take a decade or two for a polyp to even progress to cancer. And then dying from that cancer takes even longer. So I try to remind myself that when we look at only 10 years down the road, this is likely an underestimation of the true effect.
Yeah, and I think I can think of a number of other reasons why maybe the study underestimated the true effect of a colonoscopy screening. I think one thing here is that this was done in an area where colonoscopy is not widely accepted. And so if we had this RCT done, say, in the U.S., where maybe more people accept the invitation to screen, it's plausible to think that we would have seen a greater decrease in the rate of colorectal cancer.
And another really important limitation when you look at the impact of colonoscopy is the interendoscopist variation in adenoma detection rate, or ADR. ADR is the percentage of colonoscopies where at least one adenoma is detected. And remember, if you don't detect an adenoma, you can't get rid of it and you can't prevent it from causing colon cancer. And in the Nordic trial, 29% of endoscopists had an adenoma detection rate less than the recommended 25%, which is the American standard for endoscopy. And interestingly, if you look at U.S. data, the average adenoma detection rate here is about 40%, which is way higher than we saw in Nordic.
Yeah, and coming from the perspective of an internist, like I hadn't really appreciated the extent to which endoscopist variation can make such a big difference in the utility of screening.
Yeah, and Treya, not only does it make a difference in the utility of screening, but also in cancer-related deaths. So one study showed that for every 1 percentage point increase in an adenoma detection rate, is associated with a 3% reduction in future incidence of colorectal cancer and a 5% reduction in colon cancer-related death.
Yeah, so a big deal.
That's a big deal, yeah. And one other point that the authors don't really address, even in the supplementary appendix, is whether there's a difference in socioeconomic status among the patients in the group offered screening between those who accept it and those who decline it. It makes me wonder what else was different between the people in Nordic who received the screening versus those who declined it even when they were offered it.
Yeah. So many factors to take into account when we interpret these study results, which again, I think is like the more interesting parts of research, and I'm glad we're getting a chance to discuss it.
Yeah, I agree. You know, as in all things in life, we do our best to control things that are so often out of our control, but ultimately, there's always parts of the study that bias things one way or the other.
Yeah, totally. I feel like we've been detectives trying to figure it out, but this may be a good place to pause and summarize. Nordic found that inviting people to colonoscopy did have a reduction in the incidence of colorectal cancer, but no survival benefit at 10 years. And there's a few reasons why we might have not seen that mortality decrease or as high of a risk reduction. One, the follow-up period was only 10 years. Two, there was a lower incidence of adenoma detection. And lastly, there was a lower rate of people accepting screening colonoscopies after being invited.
We've really gotten into the weeds here, picking things apart in the Nordic trial, but I think it's time for us to dive into what these results actually mean for our patients.
Yeah, Greg, thanks for bringing us back to what really matters. At the end of the day, what do we tell our patients when they ask us, so what's with this colonoscopy and do I really have to do it?
Oh, man. I was actually asked this by my very like perfectionist, passive-aggressive father-in-law a few years ago during the pandemic, and I didn't know what to say. He was like, yeah, me and your mother-in-law had, you know, a colonoscopy 5-10 years ago. It was fine. And they didn't know if they should do it versus do stool testing. And I think I garbled out something about pandemic precautions, but definitely didn't feel as confident in my answer.
So Shreya, I'm not touching your relationship with your father-in-law with that 10-foot pole, but hopefully by...
Sounds like a good idea.
But hopefully if we talk about some of the broader conclusions that we can draw from this trial, it will help both you, your family, and a lot of people like you who are listening feel more confident about what we know and what we don't know about colorectal cancer screening based on the Nordic trial?
Yeah, we definitely still have a few important questions to discuss.
And so the first one in my mind is, can you make the argument that inviting people to colonoscopy saves lives from colon cancer? And the second kind of corollary to this is a reduction just in the incidence of colorectal cancer enough for you to recommend an invasive test like colonoscopy to your patients?
Great questions. My take home from the study is that inviting individuals to undergo colonoscopy pretty clearly prevents colorectal cancer. And I find the story that we've told pretty compelling to persuade me that actually undergoing the procedure is going to save lives.
I feel similarly here. After all of this controversy about the headlines about colonoscopy being overrated, when we actually dug into the details and reviewed the data, and then you take into account all of those things that we talked about, the low adenoma detection rates, the low number of people who accepted the colorectal cancer screening, and you look at that per protocol analysis. And to me, that answers the questions that I'm trying to answer with a fairly high degree of confidence, which is, does this procedure prevent colon cancer? And the answer to me is just so likely that the answer is yes.
Nice. All right. So we are thumbs up to colonoscopy, but say your patient asks you, look, can I forgo my colonoscopy? Let me just get FIT tested or Cologuard tested instead.
I think, it's a very reasonable question. And you can argue that FIT testing is a reasonable alternative to colonoscopy. However, it's important to note it's way less likely to detect adenomas. It catches cancer. But the point of screening is to prevent colon cancer, not just to find it when it's already there. And so look at the ColonPrev trial. One-time colonoscopy compared to annual FIT testing is similar in terms of cancer detection, but certainly not in the detection of adenomas, where FIT testing was only about half as good.
But then again, FIT testing does come with a very real-world benefit. People are just more likely to do it.
And it's worth noting that if FIT testing or Cologuard is positive, then you still need to do that colonoscopy. And so you can't get away without doing it in the setting of an abnormal FIT or Cologuard test.
Yeah, these are all great points. And for those of you wondering, like me, what the difference between the two are, FIT testing is just looking at the hemoglobin in the stool. So you're more likely to get false negatives, especially if there is some intermittent bleeding. And then Cologuard, on the other hand, combines both the FIT testing looking at the hemoglobin with DNA markers that we often see in colorectal cancer or precancerous adenomas. So Cologuard is going to have a higher sensitivity, but of course, the cost of more false positives.
Right. So for a patient who is skeptical about a scope, but willing to get a stool test, it's wonderful we have these other viable options.
Yeah, I agree. And I think just as a reminder, many societies like the USPSTF and the American College of Gastroenterology have actually lowered their recommendation for the screening age to 45 in an average risk individual, just because there has been a rising rate of colorectal cancer in younger populations.
Yeah, that's such an important point to note. And so while this is not the focus of this podcast, there are younger and younger people being affected by colorectal cancer, and this is a major societal and public health issue. And so understanding how we're going to frame our perspective on the benefits and drawbacks of a test like colonoscopy impacts a lot of conversations that we have. And it's not just conversations with our patients, but with our families, our friends, and our colleagues.
Yeah, especially if you're like one speed dial away for all your friends and family questions. A lot of people can probably relate. So I'm curious though, like Greg, Abby, how would you frame this now that we've done such a deep dive? What if my father-in-law had called you up expecting this perfect answer of what they should do?
I would tell him that Dr. Shreya Trivedi is a wonderful, patient, smart, brilliant, intelligent doctor. I would also
I need that.
But I would also tell your father-in-law that a colonoscopy is a low-risk test that is inconvenient for about 24 hours of your life. And it seems to me it's pretty clear that it lowers the chance that you're going to die from colon cancer. Since we're all going to end up dying from something, wouldn't it be nice to take that third most common cancer and put it way lower down on the list of things that might cause you problems?
Yeah, oh, that's a great answer.
Yeah, definitely. I can't think of many better things. And so as we're wrapping up, I want to come back to the controversy generated by this trial. A lot of the noise in the media was inflammatory and ultimately pretty confusing for our patients.
And so hopefully we've clarified a little bit of that stuff. But the bigger questions, like those policy questions that come up after Nordic, like is the cost of colonoscopy financially reasonable? Are other cheaper screening modalities good enough for most of us? Who should cover the cost of a colonoscopy? So those are questions that are really hard to answer, and I'm not going to pretend that there's a single clear, unimpeachable conclusion you can take from Nordic to answer any of those public health questions.
Yeah, me too, Greg. I'm going to leave those questions to the policy experts. At the end of the day, from a clinical perspective, I think we can all agree that in addition to what we've discussed today, counseling patients on staying away from processed meats, tobacco cessation, obesity management, consumption of less than 3 alcoholic drinks per day are all probably useful to decrease their risk of colon cancer.
Yeah, all good stuff. So I guess, guys, on that note, what do you think? Are you excited to get your upcoming colonoscopies in less than 10 to 15 years?
Shreya, I don't know if I would use the E word, but am I excited to prevent colon cancer with one relatively painless procedure? You bet I am.
And so there you have it, the 6th edition of Beyond Journal Club with NEJM Group.
And that is a wrap for today. If you found this episode helpful, please share it with your team, your colleagues, give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. It really does help people find us.
And if you have any feedback, please email us at hello@coreiampodcast.com. Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.